It's a pleasure to welcome you here. I'm Michelle Goodwin, the coordinator of this conference, Contested Commodities, Reframing the Debate on Financial Incentives in the Supply of Genetic Materials. And there are a couple of people that I want to thank, and I also want to acknowledge that this today, as you're here, you'll see lots of students in the building. It's because it's Admitted Students Weekend, so this is going to be a very busy building today. But you'll see Dean Saul Levmore, who's been very generous in his support for this conference. And of course, our keynote speaker at lunch will be Professor Richard Epstein. And Richard has also been really terrific. In fact, Richard has been very generous in his support of this conference. A person that I'd like to acknowledge and thank, though she's not in the room, though you guys can all tell her that I did, is Marjorie Holmes. And you all have been in touch with Marjorie. And Marjorie has really been quite tremendous and wonderful in helping to organize this and keep us all together. Now, today this event will be podcast, and it will also be video recorded. So within a matter of a week or two, maybe three at most, after the conference, you should be able to go to the link on the website and to hear the comments. I'm not sure that we'll be posting the video, but we will be posting the audio. All right, why are we here today? Well, in part, recent organ and tissue scandals expose the fault lines in human biological supply and demand in the United States. These scandals spread across the front pages of newspapers, reading like really tacky B-grade horror movie, you know, stories, body parts pillaged from a funeral home or crematorium, bodies pumped back with plumbing piping from Home Depot. These narratives seem very strange and offensive. These narratives are animated by the tremendous demand for human biological supply, and suppliers are resorting to very crafty and often clandestine measures to procure them. And in fact, this morning we'll hear that that's not necessarily new, I imagine, Ray. Yes. And with over 1 million allograft surgeries taking place in the United States each year, we know that demand is incredibly high, and it also seems as if we're meeting some sort of supply, but not necessarily transparently. Yet these recent body part scandals obscure other kinds of contested and equally commoditized spaces that are mapped on the human body. Wombs, ova, sperm, embryos, and children represent additional realms of human biological commodification. Here, the essences of life, the building blocks, become regularly and intensely subjected to market norms. What contributes to the differences in how these spheres, organs versus ova and the like, are perceived in the common view, regulated by the legislature, or reflected on by the judiciary, has much to do with our perceptions and normative understandings of the human body. Today, what I hope that we will do is to begin to unpack some of those questions and to think about, through different spheres, what all of this means in terms of any kind of policy that we might, in fact, want to have promulgated. Through what lenses might we want to look at this and see where the boundaries are of commodification, or should it all be an open field for us to play with? So the papers today explore some of these issues in a broad-ranging way, from tax and the criminal law to the civil law and on from there. Now, a couple of housekeeping issues before we begin. Bathrooms are outside of the door and to the right. That's always important to know. Food is right outside of the door and to the left. For lunch, that's in a couple of hours. There's going to be lots of people here, but you'll basically see a sort of ant line that we'll make through the crowds on our way to lunch. Today, the ground rules are, speakers, please pay attention to your time limit. For all of us, let's just engage robustly. And thank you all for being here.
I'd like to introduce Professor Ray Madoff. She's a professor at Boston College Law School, where she teaches and writes on all areas regarding the transmission of wealth at death. She received her bachelor's degree from Brown University and her JD and LLM in taxation from New York University School of Law. She has written numerous law review articles involving issues of death in the law and is the primary author of the Practical Guide to Estate Planning. Professor Madoff is currently writing a book exploring all aspects of legal treatment of the dead, which is going to be published by Yale University Press and is entitled Immortality in the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead. Professor Madoff.
Thank you. I have to tell everybody at Boston College that if you want a book on death, it's in my office. I have the market cornered. Anyway, today is an incredibly exciting and interesting program that was put together by Michelle, and I'm really pleased to be part of it. And I want to start us off today by looking at one aspect of this issue of the treatment of bodies and body parts, by looking at the treatment of the body, as in the dead body, through American legal history. And although I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, I kind of wish I did, because I'm going to be looking at four snapshot time periods. I'm going to be looking at the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century, and if Jake lets me, I might get to the 21st century. A little bit about how I came to this project. So, as Neville mentioned, I'm writing this book called Immortality and the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead, that looks at how the law has treated the interests of the dead in all its different areas, criminal law, civil law, reputation, secret, medical records, the whole thing. And I thought that that the section of the body, how the law, American law treats the body, I thought that'll be about 3 to 5 paragraphs. And I thought it would basically say something like, people can leave their wishes and they may or may not be enforced, and that was about it. And maybe I could add an additional paragraph on some historical thing, and that would be, then I could get up to my 3 paragraphs. 42 single pages later, I realized that, in fact, the topic was just far more interesting and complex than I had ever imagined. So what I want to do is sort of take you through some of the highlights of my research and what I found. And I want to start us off in the early years of this country. The treatment of the body under early American law was pretty much governed by 3 principles. The first one is there is no property interest in the body. The second one was the right to a Christian burial. And the third one was the use of the body for imposition of criminal penalties. So I want to just touch on these first. First of all, perhaps one of the most important developments in this whole area was that American law adopted the common law rule of corpus nullius in bonis, the body belongs to no one. The case that was most often cited for this proposition was an English case of Williams versus Williams, and that involved a man by the name of Henry Crookenden, who was an early advocate of cremation. And in his will, he left his body to his friend Eliza Williams to be dealt with in the manner provided in the letter to her. And he, in fact, did leave a letter to her, and the letter said, you know, take my body, put it under a pile of wood, and set it on fire, and then store it in this Wedgwood vase that I'm giving you, and he handed it over to her. Well, when he died, his family, rather than following that, they said, "We're going to have a funeral in the traditions of the Roman Catholic Church." And Eliza, his friend, came forth to say, "No, no, this is what he wants done." And the court, considering the case, said, "Forget it." They said, "A man cannot by will dispose of his dead body. You have no property interest in your body, and it's really not his to do with what he wants." And this, of course, came up in a tradition where the church was considered to own your body. I mean, it was brought to the American law, this notion of corpus nullius in bonis, the body belongs to no one, and it has had a huge impact on the development of this area of the law. If the law had gone the other way and said, you do own your body, something, by the way, which I think that most people, if you were to ask them on the street, they might be like, do you own your body? They'd be like, are you crazy? Like, who else would? It's my body. But apparently, it's not really seeped into the public. In fact, they don't. But if the law had gone the other way, a lot of interesting developments and changes would have occurred. First of all, constitutionally, people would have certain rights over their body. The government could not take their body without providing some form of just compensation. And the other is that if there had been an ownership interest recognized in the body, then we would have had an owner. We would have had somebody who could control the body. And as we'll see as we go through the centuries, this lack of a person who controlled the body caused a lot of problems for the future of the law. All right, it's important to remember that this was a time, no property interest in your body was not such a big problem at that time, because frankly, the body wasn't so useful. It was, if anything, sort of a problem. It was capable of spreading a lot of disease. It needed to be taken care of. And so this other rule of the right to a Christian burial and the obligation of family members to dispose of a body was a very important rule in American law. And due to time, you'll be saved the story of the man who shoved his sister in a furnace and suffered criminal penalties for it. Okay. But the third and one of the more maybe forgotten aspects of the historical treatment of the body was as a form of super capital punishment. At this time, in the 18th century, there was a great belief that widespread belief in the resurrection of the body, and that you were going to pretty much need your body in the future. And as a source of an additional punishment on criminals who had done something really, really bad, was that your body would be dismembered or handed over to a dissectionist or something, because then you'd certainly be in a pickle in the life to come when your body had been all chopped up. And because of this, there was an English law that was passed, an act for better preventing the horrid crime of murder, that required dissection of bodies of certain executed murders. And then this, too, was brought to this country. And in 1784, there's a Massachusetts law that required that a person slain in a duel would either be buried in a public place without a coffin, with a stake through his body, or given to a surgeon for dissection. These were extra punishments, and apparently people engaged in plea bargaining to say, fine, kill me, but don't dissect my body. Okay, because they wanted, it was an important thing. Okay. So that was pretty much the pre-market world of bodies. Well, moving up to another century, we're going to move up to the 18th century. We have a big wave of change in the treatment of the bodies. And this was brought about because the body that had been something that was of little value and of big burden began to have a very important function in the world, and that was as a source of dissection for medical education. The growth of medical education in the 19th century was huge. It was transformative. It was from that period of barbers and, you know, when barbers did medical things, not just cutting your hair, and in early 18th century medicine versus early 19th century medicine versus late 19th century medicine was an entirely different thing. And one of the reasons for that was because of the growth of medical education. And medical schools began to form over the century, and they decided that what separated them from other aspects of medicine, from barbers, midwives, etc., was the fact that they did anatomical studies. They dissected bodies. The problem was that as the medical education grew and as the medical field grew, the demand for bodies grew. So first it was met by criminals. Fine, you know, the state, they'd hand over the executed criminals, and they'd give them to the state for local medical schools, and they'd fight over it. The problem was that as medical schools grew, the supply was not sufficient to meet this tremendous demand. So the next source was grave robbery. Basically, people going in, digging up bodies and handing them over to the medical schools. And there were all sorts of cases of grave grave robbery that were going on, and it was a rampant problem in the 19th century. One of the reasons was because it paid so well. At one time, the going rate for a body was between $10 and $35. And this was at a time when the wages of a skilled worker were between $20 and $30 a week, or a day laborer was paid a dollar a day. So you could make more than a week's wages just coming up with one body. And sometimes you could get a lot more than that. And this caused people to become so interested in providing bodies that sometimes they didn't even wait for them to be dead. There were a number of cases. One was where a family of three was killed in Cincinnati and sold to the medical college for $100, and they were happy to buy them. They would, you know, get some fresh new bodies, bring them on in. Anyway, what was the next source? Because that wasn't such a great thing. The next source was there was a lot of deals that went on with the local poorhouses, which is where people had to live. There was no assistance for people to stay in their homes. They had to move to the poorhouses, and there was much bribery and things to get the dead bodies from the poorhouses. And reportedly, the reason that Harvard Medical School is located in Boston instead of Cambridge is because there is not a corpse to be had in Cambridge, complained the chief professor of anatomy. And so the medical school has to move to Boston so it can be near the poorhouse so they can bribe the people that run the poorhouse so they can get the body so that the students can have the bodies for dissection. Okay. This led to, this was a little bit of a PR problem for the medical schools. By the way, the medical students themselves often got involved in grave robbery. It was considered a rite of passage, and they would go and dig up the bodies, they'd liquor up, dig up some bodies. Anyway, there was a lot of riots in the medical schools at this time, and one at Columbia where seven people were killed because this was such a big problem. All right. What's that? More corpses, yes. Anyway, leave it to the economist. In response, the law stepped in because we had the supply and demand problem. And what did the law do? The law passed something called an Anatomy Act. And the first one was passed in Massachusetts. And the Massachusetts Anatomy Act basically said that if you are poor and you live in a poorhouse, when you die, your body is going to be handed over to the dissectionist. And they just, by law, provided bodies through a form of eminent domain over poor people's bodies. This was argued as a way of discouraging people from becoming wards of the state because there was still a horrible stigma. People wanted their bodies. They didn't want them to be dissected. But it, most importantly, what it did is it provided for the middle and upper classes a legal source of bodies that kept their bodies safe from the grave robbers. And so these anatomy acts passed, and they're still on the books. Massachusetts, they still say if you die and you're in a jail or in any sort of state, your body gets handed over to the anatomist. Okay, I must jump forward to the next century and the next demand. The 20th century, we had yet one more need for bodies, and that, of course, was brought about in 1967 when Dr. Christian Bernard performed the first organ transplant, and all of a sudden we had this new use of bodies, bodies to provide organs. The problem was that we had, the law was not very amenable to providing this because, one, there was no, remember corpus nullius in bonis, you don't own your body? Well, it was a little bit hard to tell who could make the decision to donate organs for organ transplants because there was no clear owner, no clear rights, and you had a kind of a mishmash of laws of a whole bunch of people could sort of, their opinions would be taken into account. It did not work very well. And the other problem, the way the law was also not that helpful, was the whole definition of death itself. It was unclear about when a person was dead. The rules for death at the time did not work well with organ transplants. Okay, so how did the law address that situation? Well, it quickly after the first organ transplant, a group formed to enact the first model statute of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act to provide a mechanism for the donation of bodies. It said, okay, this is how the decision can be made. People can donate their bodies. And quickly it was adopted in all 50 states. Although that was successful in terms of providing a mechanism for donation, it didn't work to meet the demand that was out there. So the drafters had to get back into the drafting board, as it were, and they said, well, fine, let's enact some things like, required request and presumed consent statutes, which Michelle Goodwin has written an incredibly interesting book about, which was another way of providing the bodies to meet this demand. All right, I've made it through the 20th, I have 30 seconds. All this history of need for bodies, law responds, need for bodies, law responds. This is a dance that we have gone through before, and each response has its strengths and weaknesses, as we'll see. And today we'll be seeing more of the demands response, and I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you.
To pose a few questions. So we see in Professor Madoff's talk the legal response to the changing need for cadavers and the various utility that we can derive from cadavers. So my first question involves both the capacity of the law to respond to these changing needs and also whether or not you've observed over history any capacity for the law to actually make changes in the social perception of the body itself. For example, whether or not we could imagine a progressive regulation of the body after death, such as commodifying the body, that might actually over time temper any concerns that we have over organ markets or body markets themselves?
That's a really interesting question. And, you know, it's so hard to know. I mean, obviously, I think one of the big aspects, which was the whole pull of the religious resurrection of the body, that was a significant impediment at the time to getting the public on board. And now I think there are sort of some minor ways in which the law does reflect this. So I'll give you one. One is that there's a limited movement of criminals on death row, convicted criminals on death row who want to engage, who want to give their organs, and they can't. Sort of an interesting turnaround because, and you see victims saying, you know, they have given up their right to give their organ. It's seen as a privilege that shouldn't be extended to convicted criminals that way. So I think there's some subtle ways in which the law has shaped this, and I assume could as in other ways as well. So are there other questions from the audience about? Yes.
Fascinating, by the way. In my own research, I came across historical documentation of a racial disparity in the way that these death and destruction laws were passed out. Some states did pass laws saying that members of the colored caucuses, whose execution is necessary to the national security, should be dissected.
Really?
Yes.
And that's in the statutes themselves?
In the statutes themselves. And some municipal statutes entertained, but did not always pass, not only regulations pertaining to black prisoners who were executed, but also arrangements with medical schools. I mean, if you check my book, it will be referencing some of the medical schools that propose we will actually take care of disposing of the bodies of these black people who under a sentence of death
conception,
which of course benefits the school.
Yes.
Have a cadaver.
Oh, that's amazing. I've definitely wanted. What's your book called again?
Medical Apartheid.
That's great. And of course, there was a huge racial disparity in terms of the which cemeteries were sort of open for grave robbing. It was a horrible. It was a horrible cost imposed on the African American community. Yes.
Was there a benefit side to any of this? What I mean by that is, you know, these bodies were stolen, and I'm not going to try to defend theft. The question is, if you could sort of organize a market in bodies, transplants, and so forth, is there any way to estimate the lives saved because of superior instruction, anatomical research, and stuff like that, which would give us some sense as to whether or not this is a case in which you just want to shut down the operation or not? Because I do know, just the one point, is that there's this constant battle about animals and about human bodies, and most of the docs that I speak to, and the ones here can correct me if I'm wrong, say there's just no other way that you can teach certain things unless you engage in dissection.
Right.
Look at that, and you know, if we have a zero supply and a strong need, that's an imperfection. So how would you recommend that we bridge the gap? What ought to be done?
I mean, I could repeat the question.
That's what you can.
The bodies that could be used to it could be sort of highlighted more, that you wouldn't have had this in some defense of the grave robbing, et cetera,
or in defense of trying to get an organized market to avoid.
Right. I think that we can't underestimate the transformation of the notion of what a dead body is. Is it something that's sort of a leftover to be discarded, or is it something that is really essential to you in eternity? And if you believed, as large portions of the population did in the 19th century, that your body was needed for you to participate in immortality, then I think any benefit during life, it wouldn't even rise to that level. Now, I don't think that is a widely held belief in modern American culture.
No, but that doesn't answer the question, because suppose we would, I think the real source here is, you mentioned the indefinite nature of property rights in the bodies, and mm-hmm. I think that's the key to the issue. And what I would say is this, you let people voluntarily sort. Those whose bodies are immortal, don't sell. Those whose bodies are leftovers, do sell. And what happens is the numbers that you need,
right.
It's the same thing with what Ben talks about organs, is you don't have to get 100% to get a market.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is get 2% to
right.
get the market going. And so was there an allowance of voluntary transactions at this time?
No, there was no sense of voluntary transactions.
Why you get the grave dig. See, I mean, the point about it is, it's not that you
right,
have a market. It's you don't have a market, that's why you're doing the theft.
Isn't that the source of all problems? I think that is right. I mean, that could have been a way of meeting the demands at the time. Absolutely.
What's the coulda? It was a way. I mean.
Well, I mean, it was, except for that it wasn't. Yes.
It wasn't allowed. But I mean, I think that, you know, one of the arguments that I would stress it in trying to get this thing out right is the shutdown of voluntary transfers on a self-sorting mechanism leads to coercion in an obnoxious fashion. Because the market will distinguish the religious from the non-religious, and the grave diggers, of course, couldn't care less.
Right. I think that that's absolutely right.
Okay. So, yes. So now you're a marketeer too now, right?
One more question.
One more question, yes.
How did they persuade religious authorities, religious people, to change their perception of the need for the body for resurrection? I mean, this wasn't something like the Mormons discovering that polygamy was wrong. How did it come about?
I don't know.
Repeat the question.
Yes, I'm sorry. So the question was, how did it come about that there was a change in sense about the body?
Did that come from the top down?
I don't think it was a top down conversion, but it would be very interesting. I'd be fascinated to know the answer to that.
Also motivated by individual actors who are part of religious groups who see the benefits of technology, right? So if you want to be saved, and you know that Harvard Medical School or Johns Hopkins or Michigan has had a great supply of cadavers and great anatomy schools, regardless of your religion, if in fact you're motivated to save your life, that in fact you will go.
Although I think there are those people who firmly believe in an immortality that they factor into their lives, feel that whatever happens here on earth is so short-lived that you don't really want to, you know, you're trading, you know, eternal whatever for, you know, an extra cup of coffee at Starbucks. It's not really worth it. And so,
well, who knows?
It's the present.
Present.